thanks for joining us for another episode of LID Radio Podcast. I'm your host for today, Francesca Stainer, and for this episode, we're talking to Alan and Sam Williams about their book, The Values Economy, How to Deliver Purpose-Driven Service Sustained Performance. Alan Williams coaches progressive leaders of service sector organisations internationally and in the UK. He is a published author and speaker whose projects have delivered measurable business results across a balanced scorecard and have been recognised with industry awards. Sam Williams works across the change management life cycle to deliver people and technology-led business change. He is passionate about identifying the need for change, mapping out the path to benefit realisation and helping organisations to move from the outlined as-is state to an improved and more mature to-be state that improves efficiency and quality. Now about the book, The Values Economy. The exponential rate of change and disruption in the world means that traditional organisation structure-led approach is no longer fit for purpose. In this book, The Values Economy, the authors explain how the three primary influences of choice, communication, and control have created a new paradigm that they refer to as the values economy. Leaders of organizations can survive and thrive in this brave new world by implementing a tried and tested, detailed methodology which can be applied in any setting. The core principle is alignment, with a specific focus on areas of brand identity, employee engagement, and customer experience. This helps establish a sense of shared values with all stakeholders and equips the organisation with the agility needed to deliver sustained performance in a dynamic business environment where disruption is the new normal. The authors combined baby boomer and Gen Z perspectives, providing a compelling and irresistible blend of sharp insight, storytelling, operational know-how and pragmatic hopefulness, bringing the theory to life with a range of case studies and stories from different sectors, sizes and stages of maturity. So thank you so much for joining us today, Alan and Sam. Can you tell us a bit about what inspired you to write The Values Economy, what its significance is today? And you keep coming back to this framework of elements of brand identity, employee engagement, customer experience, systems and processes, and measurement and insight throughout the book. What kind of relevance does that have and why was it important to do that?
Yeah, well, in terms of inspiration, I've been using this approach with clients for 15 years. And it just seemed that over the last couple of years, it's all of a sudden or gradually become much more relevant because of the way society is changing. And that's the values economy piece. And the second piece, I suppose, was Sam's involvement, because when I was thinking about this book, it struck me that it would just be so valuable to the reader to have a multi-generational perspective rather than just the one. So that's what inspired the book. And then in terms of the framework, the reason that we keep returning to that is that it's really the skeleton or the structure of the book. So in the introduction, we outline the framework. Then in the framework section, we dive deep into it in detail. Then we apply the framework to the mini case studies. And then we look at some relevant topics that people need to consider through that lens of the framework as well. So it's really the spine of the book running all the way through it.
Just to add to that, I think it's that comparison between generations that I find really interesting. So for me, it's not a change that I've noticed. My generation have grown up in it and have most likely made unconscious decisions based on their values. Whereas for Dad, it's different. He's seen the change over time, seen organizations fail to attempt to adapt for the sake of it without truly understanding the importance of that change actually being genuine. So that contrast between the two of us and the view that we've had of the values economy is what's really interesting to me.
Yeah, especially as you know, you read so much about how generational values are so different, especially in business and how businesses are trying to adapt to that. It's really interesting to have both your views in the book. It does offer something different, and it's something, as you said, we haven't really seen a lot of before. I mean, moving on to sort of the book in more detail, it's split into these sort of four parts, which I think it's important to go through individually. But part one is groundwork. Can you explain what the service brand approach is which I think is probably one of the most important things, and how it links to the importance of the values in an organisation.
Sure, and you're dead right. That is the heart of the book. And it's really quite a simple concept. So what it says is that most organisations tend to operate in a very siloed way, particularly in the areas of brand identity, which is usually owned by marketing, all of the people stuff, which is owned by human resources, and then the customer service delivery, which is owned by operations. Now, in my experience over the years, not just big companies, but reasonably small companies as well, can sometimes fall into the trap of developing strategy in each of those areas unilaterally. They don't talk to each other, and then they're surprised when it doesn't work. So the service brand approach very simply says you need to align your thinking across brand identity, employee engagement, and customer experience. You then need to support that with all of the systems and processes in the business, and also the measurement and insight that you're going to check in order to understand how you're progressing, and make sure that everything is aligned all the way through. And in terms of relevance of the values of the organization, that is at the heart of the brand identity. So previously, you know, we talked a bit about generations here. When I was growing up, brand identity was something that the marketing guys fabricated and then invested money in marketing and PR and advertising and kind of hoped that they would be able to convince people that that's what the organization was. Whereas increasingly, organizations are just the way they behave and the decisions they make, and people judge them on that.
And then to tie into the point of the question around the importance of values in an organization and how the service brand approach ties into that, I think it's important to bring out that values are the starting point for an organization. The service brand approach doesn't help organizations define their values, it helps them practice them instead. So it's important that organizations don't try and work backwards. They don't need to identify a brand identity that they want to portray and then work out the values from there, because that's working the wrong way. And the world that we live in is too transparent, and you can't really pull the wool over consumers' eyes in the world that we live in with social media and all the other kind of transparent elements of industries and kind of communications as well. So I think it needs to have a really genuine focus, and organizations have to understand what actually matters to them and work from there.
I mean, do you think, sort of touching on social media, do you think that because of social media, brands have had to be more forward and more open with their values and really take them seriously? I wonder if without sort of the influence of social media, this would have happened anyway.
Yeah, I think so, because I don't think bad news stories can spread as fast without social media. And I also think that social media means that organizations have to be truer to their values than they maybe previously could have got away with being. They could have said that they were X, Y, and Z, and people may have just believed that. But given social media and given the power that essentially kind of gives to the consumer or the public as well, I don't think organizations can get away with that as easily. So they actually have to really resonate and actually practice those values.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the book, we talk about how the values economy, or what we refer to as the values economy, is really driven by lots of things, but we've identified the three primary drivers. So there's control, there's choice, but the third one is communication, which is what we've just been talking about, because you know, people can share a view or an opinion to millions of people around the world in a heartbeat. And that was not the case 10 years ago.
I mean, talking a bit more about what we've just mentioned in terms of why it always falls on marketing brand identity. So part two of the book is framework. And what was particularly interesting, as we've said, is that brand identity shouldn't fall on marketing, but I wanted to talk a little more about this and why it's important, you think, to include it in the section of framework and perhaps going forward where actually brand identity should be falling.
Well, it's this thing around alignment again, because, you know, traditionally marketing has been this separate function that go and do their magic, and then the organization fulfills the orders and all the rest that result from that work. But ultimately today, organizations are nothing more than the behavior and choices of their employees. So, you know, if the marketing department, say, were all about innovation. But then at a call center, when a customer's ringing with a complaint and the call center operator is not showing any innovative thinking about the way they're dealing with their issue, then the customer's just, well, at best is going to be confused, and at worst is just going to mistrust the organization. So that's why I think it's a really false picture to be thinking of marketing as the one function that creates the image of the organization, whereas every single touch point plays a part in doing that.
Yeah, and I think the organizations with the strongest brand are those organizations that aren't just dependent on their marketing department to create their brand identity. We'll touch on the case study part of the book in later, but I think the Wimbledon example is a really strong one. So their brand is built right from the start of the customer experience. So whether that's from the tennis court on the platform at the train station, to the themed flowers on route to the walk, to the club, or the well-kept grounds, or the minimal branding that you see around the grounds as well. Their brand is so strong that they don't really need to push it through marketing. On the other hand, organizations, I think, who drive their brand identity just through marketing without alignment across other areas of the organization actually have less impact. So if you look at big energy firms that promote renewable energy, for example, is that marketing creating a brand identity because of fear of public perception and the power of social media, which we touched on in that previous question? Or is it actually genuine, and do they have alignment across the organization? And they may well do, but I think it's just that the strongest brands, whilst marketing may play a part, brand identity is driven across the whole organization because of that element alignment piece.
So I suppose sort of those brands with those strong foundations in terms of their values are basically marketing themselves without having to try as hard.
Yeah, because I think they have that understanding because the values are so understood across the organization. Everyone is already on the same page and are making decisions unconsciously driven by the same values. Whereas if those values aren't genuine, the marketing department are having to try and drive that brand identity off supposed values, which they think the public want them to see because of the positive perception that they think they will achieve from that. Yeah,
I think the difference is that in the situation that Sam was describing there, where perhaps you haven't got such a strong aligned approach, the marketing function is kind of all about persuasion. Whereas when you do have that alignment across the piece, marketing is more about just awareness. So it doesn't have to kind of be seen to be trying so hard. And in that way, actually, it's more trusted.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. It's more genuine because it's coming through from every department rather than just from that one sector, I guess, of the brand. But I think it'd be interesting to talk now about part three, which is the practice. And we've sort of touched on some of the case studies like Wimbledon. But this practice element of the book goes into these mini case studies of organizations in lots of different sectors, different geographies as well. And they bring kind of these previous chapters to life of the great groundwork and framework. Were there any case studies that showed the values economy in practice and particularly well?
I think just to kind of go back to the focus of this kind of part of the book for us and the value that I see that it adds, because obviously in the case studies, Dad was closer to those than me. They're kind of his case studies, his anecdotes. But the importance of this section of the book for me was around how case studies make it easier to interpret theory. I've always, whether it's kind of in my line of work now or whether it was when I was studying, felt that putting theory into practice and seeing theory in practice makes it much more kind of applicable kind of in your brain. And you understand that implementation process more easily, and you can kind of see the value that it adds. And I think in the question you actually touched on it, the diversity of sectors in the case studies, as well as geographies, shows how widely applicable that framework is. And without all those different examples, I think it's harder to envisage how a framework can be implemented across a variety and a breadth of sectors as well as geographies, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and I, from my side, I'm an operator at heart. So, you know, I used to work in the hospitality sector to start with, And it was my job to run businesses, to inspire teams of people to represent the business and to deliver great customer service to our guests. And I've always believed that theory is kind of overrated, and it only is of value if you can apply it in a particular context. And so that's why I think the case studies are such an important part of this book. And when we were searching for them, it was an intention to show that the service brand lens could be relevant across all of these different types of business, which we were able to realize. And in terms of your question around which ones really stood out, I thought that was a great question, because when I was thinking about this, it seems to me that it's those businesses that have been true to what they stand for over a long period of time that have been able to do that most easily. So just looking at the case studies that we've chosen, you know, Timpson has done a fantastic job around maintaining what they stand for over generations. Nordstrom have been known for their fantastic customer service for generations. And Wimbledon, Sam and I were laughing because we compared notes about the first time that we had visited Wimbledon. And despite the fact that it was something like, what was it, 30 years apart, our comments about our first impression were very, very similar. So I think that those are three great examples of how, when it's embedded over time, relentlessly, that's when you're at your strongest. And then just one final comment. In the Aston Martin case study, we reported how there was a change of ownership at the most senior level. And that kind of just hit home that whilst the service brand approach is a brilliant operating model, it really can't cater for a change at that level, because that changes everything.
I think, yeah, similarly to what Sam said, I think so many of business books have this theory and you kind of get to the point where, oh, yes, that sounds fantastic. And then you sort of sit back and think, you know, how do I actually make this happen or make these changes? And I think it's only through those sort of mini case studies that you have that you can find one that's similar to your sector, find one that's similar to your geography and think, oh, okay, now it's starting to click and make sense. So that was a really interesting part for me as well.
Yeah, that's dead right. And in the book, we talk about our best hope is not that somebody reads the book. You know, our best hope is that somebody does something different as a result of reading the book. And that's how we kind of measure whether we've been successful with this project or not.
Right. I mean, part four is implementation, arguably one of the most crucial parts of the book, because it helps to explain why the service brand approach makes sense in the values economy and the areas to pay attention to when you're implementing it, as you've mentioned. I mean, I'd like to talk a bit about inclusion and sustainability, which are at the heart of many business conversations, especially at the moment. What should people bear in mind in these areas?
So I think that we'll look at inclusion first. And when myself and Dad were talking around this implementation section and the different kind of areas to bring out, we deliberately chose the term inclusion over diversity because we wanted to highlight the importance of everybody having a voice. And from a business change perspective, giving everyone a voice is so crucial in ensuring that everyone is actually engaged in that change. People want to participate in change. They want to help define change. They don't want to just be changed and not have a say. So where change, where people feel like it's happening to them, has a much lower success rate. And I don't think you can really expect employees to be engaged if they don't feel like they have a voice. I imagine that people have heard a lot of stories of senior figures in organizations announcing a change that they'll be making through kind of one-way communication channels with no interaction. And that's fine if it's followed up with further communication and involving others and encouraging participation. But I think the key part of that inclusion piece is that if you want this to be successful over the long term, you need to get everybody on board and you need to get everyone involved and participating, because it's not just something that a senior leadership team can announce and will immediately be successful. The second point that you mentioned was sustainability. To be clear, we're not referencing sustainability in relation to depletion of natural resources, we're instead talking about organizational sustainability. So an organization's ability to manage their current state without compromising their future state. So in terms of the term, obviously very similar to sustainability that is very topical on the natural front. But it refers to kind of being able to sustain the new approach that is being adopted. So consistency in approach is absolutely key. Organizations that aren't truly invested in implementing the framework will fail because they either won't place enough importance on the value of alignment between the different elements of the framework, or they won't take a consistent enough approach in implementation. If it's kind of paying lip service for the sake of trying to implement a framework because they think it will have positive impact and there's not real investment there, then I think they'll fail. And to kind of summarize and bring the two together, the long-term success is really key. So inclusion and sustainability, I think, define long-term success in terms of implementation of the framework, because without inclusion, without sustainability, you won't have that long-term success.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Surprise, surprise. And this for me is about how the service brand approach and the framework is not this kind of off-the-shelf thing that you do in exactly the same way wherever you are. It provides instead a freedom within a framework, so you can absolutely tailor it to your set of circumstances and your context. And then, just like Sam says, I certainly know through my career that I've seen so many projects that kind of start, they've got a budget, they last for a year or so, the budget runs out, and then it just dies. Whereas the framework provides a structure that is ongoing, and that means that the performance can be sustained as long as there's robust enough governance around managing and overseeing that.
I think it's also been really interesting to see, in terms of sustainability, sort of the brands through this pandemic that have kind of kept to their core values despite all the disruption. I mean, the amount of phone companies that sort of offered free calls to over 60s, kind of the do-gooders, I think, that have stuck to what they were preaching at about before this all happened. They've come out on top, and it's been very clear to see that those that had those strong values and kept them going despite this have actually been the ones that have been sort of claimed the heroes of this situation. And the ones that haven't have, you know, more often than not been sort of slated by consumers and social media, or whether it's in the press as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I think you've got at least three different types of company. You've got the ones that you've described who have been true to what they stand for all the way through, and those companies have gained a lot of respect. You've got the companies that have been just what you might expect them to be, so not particularly caring, but they don't pretend to be. And so people don't like that, but they kind of accept it a bit more easily. And then probably the third category that people despise most are those companies that say one thing and behave in a different way. And that really gets under people's skin. And it'll be interesting to see how long people's memories are, actually, because, you know, we're really good at complaining about something today. But in, you know, 3 months' time, if we want that product or if we want that service, will we remember the behaviour at this time? I'm not so sure. It'll be interesting to see.
Yes, definitely. I think time will tell on a lot of these things. Lastly, for anyone interested in knowing more about you and your work, both of you, whereabouts can they find you?
So I'm at www.servicebrandglobal.com, and I'm on LinkedIn, and I try to be on Twitter under @ our service brand.
Yeah, I'm also on LinkedIn. Sam Williams is where you can find me there. There may be a lot of Sam Williams that come up in that search result. So I work for BAE Systems Applied Intelligence to refine that search down.
Amazing. And we'll include all the links to find you in the show notes as well, so people can click straight through. But amazing. Thank you so much. That was really great. Thank you to Alan and Sam Williams, and thank you everyone as well for listening. Do remember to keep an eye on our social media at Lid Publishing on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, and at Lid Business Media on LinkedIn. We'll be posting more podcasts, thought leadership from people such as Alan and Sam. Take care and see you next time on Lid Radio Podcast.